Welcome to Red Ice Radio, new and regular listeners. My name is Henrik Palmgren and we are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia. You can follow us online at redicecreations.com and we offer radio, webcasts, films, video interviews and of course news, frequently updated. We have an archive with a year of programs available for you, and if you like what we do and want to get access to our full programs, both ours or programs that has been up on our website over a year, we encourage you to sign up with us for a membership on our website and get full access to our archives. All information is available on our website, redicecreations.com. And today we have Nick Pelling with us from the UK. He's written a book called Curse of the Voynich, The Secret History of the World's Most Mysterious Manuscript. And we are, of course, going to discuss the Voynich manuscript here today. Nick's website is ciphermysteries.com, where you can find more information about Nick, his book, and about some of the other projects and ciphering enigmas that he's currently involved with. And I'll just give you guys a quick overview here before we bring Nick on. The Voynich manuscript is a mysterious, undeciphered, illustrated book. It is thought to have been written in the 15th or 16th century. The author, script, and language of the manuscript remain unknown. This is according to Wikipedia, at least. Over its recorded existence, the Voynich manuscript has been the object of intense study by many professional and amateur cryptographers, including some top American and British codebreakers from World War II fame, all of whom failed to decrypt any portion of the texts. This string of failures has turned the Voynich manuscript into a famous subject of historical cryptology, but it has also given weight to the theory that the book is simply an elaborate hoax, a meaningless sequence of arbitrary symbols. The book is named after the Polish-American book dealer Wilfried M. Voynich, who acquired it in around 1912, and currently the Voynich manuscript is stored in the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library of Yale University as item MS-408. So we'll try to dig into this mystery here today with our guest, Nick Pelling. Welcome to the program, Nick. Thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure, absolutely.
It's so good to have you here, Nick. And I just kind of stumbled over you as I searched for some of the material out there about this manuscript. It's been out there, to my knowledge, for a long time. I stumbled over it a couple of years ago, and I actually haven't spent that much time on trying to understand it. But obviously, as I mentioned here in the introduction, there's a lot of mystery here surrounding this this particular document. So maybe you just can tell us a little bit generally about your kind of background in regards to cryptography and when you first stumbled over the Voynich documents or manuscripts.
About a decade ago, I was writing a book, a novel, and I was doing some novel research for it. It had some themes that are kind of fairly familiar now, like historical ciphers, Knights Templar, Opus Dei, all kinds of things that a certain Mr. Dan Brown sorted out and put my book plans in the shade somewhat. But while I was researching it, I stumbled across the Voynich manuscript. I thought I'd seen all cipher mysteries, but then when I found the Voynich manuscript, I thought, no, the truth is stranger than fiction. This, whatever I was planning to write, this trumps it. This is the mystery. And I basically just dropped the writing project on the spot and started learning more and more about the Voynich manuscript. So basically, I became interested in why such a thing should be unbreakable to our modern eyes. That's the mystery, isn't it? Why can't we break it?
Yes, and how about cryptography? Have you been studying this for a long time?
I've got a background in mathematics and applied mathematics. And so, you know, a lot of these things like entropy and statistical testing were things that I did regularly, but not for that. So it was kind of an easy fit for the skill set I had.
And maybe you then can give us a little bit of an outline on the documents from your perspective, what you've kind of discovered in regards to the documents and a little bit of how you kind of approached the subject from this background of cryptography.
Well, I think the real issue is more about history, because cryptography really depends on what you know about it in the first place. The reason that a lot of the Enigma broadcasts were broken was because of lazy cryptography, because they almost always started Heil Hitler, and that made it very easy to break. you know, and weather reports always came out at 7 a.m, that kind of thing. So they would know that the plain text was German. They knew what it was about, and that helped them reduce the search tremendously. And similarly, the Voynich manuscript, if you could say where it came from, you could reduce the amount of possibilities tremendously. So without historical information, there are too many possibilities for cryptography to really get any kind of grasp on it. So right from the start, I pretty much said to myself, it has to be a historical problem first to locate it. Where did it come from? And it seemed ludicrous to me that nobody could actually answer that question. And I spent maybe 8 years trying to solve historical mystery so that we can then move on to the cryptography mystery.
What are some of the history that you got involved in order to try to understand the Voynich manuscript?
Well, the history of the Voynich manuscript, it's a very nebulous and very odd thing. It should be very, very obvious, but it's not. And that's a secondary mystery. So it's a mystery shrouded in another mystery, and which is why it's so frustrating. However, 7 or 8 years on, I can say definitively that it was made between 1450 and 1500. And so that's probably in northern Italy. So that's a very tight range of dates. And you can say that there are some very specific types of shading. If you look at Leonardo da Vinci's drawings, you often see fine parallel lines to get kind of mid-tones behind, for example, his Vitruvius Man. If you look at those, they're called parallel hatching. Now, parallel hatching appeared in Florence in 1440 and in Venice in 1450 and then spread to the rest of Europe. But before then, it was absolutely invisible. It was just not there at all. And so the presence of parallel hatching in the Voynich manuscript is a pretty sound indication that it wasn't made before 1440 and probably not before Florence, or not before 1450 in Venice or anywhere else. So that's an earliest date. As for the latest date, well, you can say that if you look at some of the writing that's been added to it, they're very clearly in a 15th century handwriting. So that which disappeared around 1500 completely. So you can say pretty much with a very high degree of certainty that it was made not before 1450 and not after 1500. And that's a really great first step.
And do you know if the paper or ink has been tried to be dated in any way?
Yes, it has, but the results haven't been released. There's an Austrian TV documentary being made, a lavish production that's coming out next year. The filmmakers approached the Beinecke and they said, can we do some tests? And the library said, actually, yes, you can. And they said, well, okay, we'll do the tests as long as you don't let anybody else do the tests before we've announced our results. And they said, okay. So we're now in the situation where the tests were done at the beginning of the year. There were dating tests on the vellum and some other presumably spectroscopic tests on the ink and the paints. And various other, I don't know, probably non-destructive testing. And that was the results of that will appear probably early next year, whenever their documentary airs.
And do you...
Which I understand, they're editing the documentary right now, so it's fairly soon.
There you go. Do you think that you'll agree with the conclusion that they make?
I would be very hard... If they said it was circa 1600 or circa 1300... I'd be extremely surprised. Really, the art history dating seems very, very solid. And there's a certain amount of variation that's allowed in the inks and stuff, and then the dating. So it could be like plus or minus, say, 40 years, just randomly.
And you mentioned probably northern Italy as well in regards to region. How can you be so specific in regards to the region here?
There's a page called the Nine Rosette page, and with nine circles on it, it kind of folds out into like a big fold-out sheet. And if you really look at it really, really carefully, I think that the central rosette clearly depicts the Basilica of St. Mark in Venice as viewed from the Campanile, the bell tower that was just right next to it. And I went up the Campanile and I looked down there, and I really think that the two it's some kind of obscured representation of it, but I more than that I can't say. But that's one thing. I also think that another there's a castle that's represented there. I think that that's this what's called the Castello Sforzesca in Milan. But again, there's room for a very difference of opinion there.
Yes.
But they're basically both very kind of specific, well-known northern Italian architectural features.
This picture that you're talking about here, is this the threefold? We have three different basically circles on them, which has different kind of star patterns inside?
It's a 3x3 picture. It's Folio 86, I think.
86. Not 68?
No. That's one of the. That's Astro. That's the astronomical section.
Yes, exactly. Okay, yes.
I think it's F85.
F85, okay. Well, we can
have. Folio 85, yeah.
Can definitely link up some pictures here as well during the program, so people can follow along. Yeah, because it's really interesting. And what can you say in regards to, you know, generally over some of the content here, though? Why is the document so interesting? Why spend any time on it at all? Is it just because it's a mystery, or do you think that really is some vital key information inside the document?
I have no idea. What interests me the most is what kind of knot someone could tie 550 years ago that we can't untie, and what kind of mental process did they go through in order to do that? Because that's a work of genius. I think that's probably the best description is that when you get to understand the Voynich manuscript, you realize that you're in the presence of some kind of either genius or madness. And the more you understand the rationality and the patterns and the symmetry, that you realize it's not madness, it's genius. And it's the single most frustrating and gloriously strange object that almost compels people to project themselves onto it. It's great.
And what can you say in regards to some of the content? It has this allure in regards to that there is almost secrets about nature in there, and as you said, there's constellations, zodiacal constellations. There's an awful lot of apparently information about life on this planet, even encoded into the document. Do you think that's true? Is that the case?
I think it's a book of secrets. I mean, there is a genre of books called books of secrets that were active in the 15th and 16th century. Now, in the 16th century, they became printed books of secrets, and people became very interested in them. And there's quite a lot of academic literature on that. On the stuff in the 15th century, not so much, but there are quite a few. The only really comparable one, I think, is from Paduan called Giovanni di Fontana, or Giovanni Fontana, who's a very brilliant, very little-known person. He did all kinds of strange drawings and strange things, kind of inventions and fountains and pipes and projective lanterns and shapes, and he wrote all his notes around it in Latin, but in very, very simple cipher. Now, that was done in the beginning of the 15th century, and I think that the Voynich manuscript is very much in that sphere of activity. It's a book of secrets. Most books of secrets had a very middle-class feel to them, insofar as they were ordinary people aspiring to some kind of influence or power, and so it's kind of aspirational thing. Both his books of secrets and Voynich have been created to advance the interests of the person by encoding the things that they found and the things they've invented. and their own look, their own view of the world.
If we talk a little bit about Wilfried Voynich, the man who discovered, do you think that he kind of fits into that genre that you just described, or maybe you can tell us something else about him?
Well, there's a lot of things that link him in, as a personality. I mean, he was trained as a chemist at university, and I think there's an awful lot of interest for someone who's a chemist in there. They look like recipes. It looks like a kind of visual pharmacopoeia in the end section. Lots of drawings of ingredients, little drawings of roots and shapes and faces. So that's kind of a thing that links a lot of people to it. I think a lot of people have a kind of, a pharmaceutical or chemical kind of link to it. And but it's very easy to project your desires onto it too. And really, as an antiquarian book dealer, Wilfried Voynich's basic, most dearest felt desire was to discover a book by Roger Bacon. And when he saw this, and the letter that came with it said, people have said it might be by Roger Bacon, but I reserve judgment. Well, that kind of did it for him. I'm sure that he read that and thought, well, that's it. This is what I've been looking for. This is the Roger Bacon sequence. And he's basically spent the next 15 years trying to find people who would support him in this proof. People such as poor old Newbold, who basically went mad trying and died.
And there's other people in there as well. We can talk about, I think John Dee even has gotten a whack at it, together with Edward Kelly and so forth. There's another character called Gordon Rook. Go ahead.
Yeah, the Dee link is quite interesting, because really the evidence for Dee is fairly slim to minimal. But when Wilfried Voynich looked at this thing, there's evidence of stuff in the Bohemian court, because the same letter says, well, I was told by a friend that it had been bought by the emperor for lots of money. And that'd been Rudolf. And the question is, if you've got Roger Bacon on one hand in England and Rudolf on the other hand in Bohemia, how did they manage to get from one to the other?
Yeah.
You know, it's a very old-fashioned kind of join-the-dots history that sees history in terms of big, important people, and forgets that there's like a million other people at the same time doing other things. But I think Wilfried Voynich kind of succumbed to big man history and said, the only way that this manuscript could have got from England is if it had been carried across there by John Dee, all the way to Bohemia. And that's a bit of a thin way of looking at history. You know, there's once you understand the links between people and the communities, the way the world actually works, you know, the world isn't just kings and queens. The world is and emperors and popes. The world's millions of people doing stuff and trying stuff. You know, and John Dee wasn't powerful. He was just one of the many people trying to do things at the same time that hoped to be powerful but never were. So, you know, there were countless links that could have, even if it had been Roger Bacon, which it isn't, there were still a million other ways that any given document could have travelled from England to Bohemia.
Yes.
So Voynich was just a bit wishful thinking. And the idea that the folio numbering at the top is definitely Dee's or definitely Kelly's, doesn't really hold up.
It doesn't?
Not at all. The 16th century is full of people with almost identical handwriting. What happened was that in the 16th century, the printed books came out with lots of pictures showing how to write. And all of a sudden, people stopped learning in schools. They never really learned much in school anyway, but they started learning from books, and they would duplicate the newfangled handwriting as best they could. And so all of a sudden, whereas writing in the 15th century had been very varied, all of a sudden this kind of uniform template stamps down on the writing 16th century, and an awful lot of the writing becomes the same. You know, lots of writing books just ripped off each other's illustrations of writing, mm-hmm. and what became like a fashion landslide. So, you know, yes, it could be Dee's, but there's probably literally 100,000 other people it could be, and that's lousy odds.
Ah, do you think it was in the possession of John Dee at one point?
I'd say there's about a 1 in 1,000 chance. But, you know, I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's not the kind of certainty that people hold on to that it has to be Dee's or it has to be Kelly's. Just doesn't really stack up.
And you know, again, Cetera, as you pointed out, Rudolf the Second, the Holy Roman Emperor, he allegedly bought the book at one point. Do you know what happened to it after that? Have you kind of tracked the history of the different owners and where it has ended up consequently?
There are a whole bunch of people who've done this, mainly René Zambergen. And he's a great guy, and he's done lots of work over the years. And the Austrian documentary makers are bringing all this together, I'm sure, for their documentary next year. But I think the story that it appeared in the Rudolfine court, kind of circa 1600 or so, it does stack up. That makes sense. You know, I've got no reason to say that that's absolutely wrong. That does make sense. It pops up into Rudolf's imperial distillers or property a few years later because that's Synapius, because his signature appears on the first page, kind of erased on F1R. So, yeah, I can completely think that his presence in Rudolfine Court is a pretty near certainty. The interesting questions are what happened before that. What happened after that is fairly insubstantial. But what happened before that is a whole different ball game.
Maybe you want to get into that a little bit then. What happened before? And do you think that any of the information contained within the manuscript have been successfully deciphered and, I guess, applied or used in any way?
I think I would give an upper limit of probably one word has been deciphered, but nobody knows which one that is. There's you know, basically no. I don't believe a single person has deciphered a single word of it. Not even me. I really don't.
And
I would love it to be true, but I just don't think anyone has. there's some very good reasons for that.
Do you want to get into that?
Yeah. Okay. But I think I'll digress a little bit,
yes,
and then I'll come back to it.
Right.
But the digression is really about what the letters look like. Now, when you look at Voynich's, the actual letters of the Voynich manuscript, you find all kinds of very familiar, oddly familiar things that you keep on looking and thinking, well, that's familiar, that's familiar, that's kind of familiar, that's a bit strange, but that's familiar. And about a couple of years back, last year, I guess, I kind of pieced together one of the things. There's one of the patterns that appears again and again and again and again all through the manuscript is it looks like an A followed by multiple, one or more I's, and followed by either an R or a V. Now, if you were to our modern eyes, that looks like a fairly strange little set of arbitrary letters, like air or ave. But actually, wind the clock back 500 years, and that looks like something very, very specific. That looks like medieval page number reference. Now, if you're referring to doing a cross-reference in a medieval document, which not many people did, but some people did, you would write the name of the choir, which is like a group of pages, and then followed by the page, the folio number inside it, in Latin, like 1, 2, 3, or 4, whatever. And you'd follow that by either R for recto, meaning the front, or V for verso. And the first choir would normally be numbered or named A. So AIIV is choir A, page 3, folio 3, backside, the underside of it. Mm-hmm, so it's a page reference. And so you've got page references all the way through the text. And there's no question at all that that's what it's supposed to look like. It's not an accident. The chances of that being a coincidence or some other language or just something, it's intended to look like page references.
So it's referencing, the document is referencing itself inside the document, so to speak.
Well, the strange things about it is firstly, it only references choir A. It doesn't reference any other choirs. Okay?
Mm.
The second odd thing is that it appears to reference the verso pages tens of times more than recto pages. So, and also they smaller page numbers are much, much more frequent than larger page numbers. And there's no sign that it refers to higher page numbers like page folio 10 or 20, something like that. It's a very strange kind of thing. Because actually, as a page number, it makes no sense. But it was obviously meant to look like a page number.
Hmm.
Now, this gives you a kind of an idea of what's going on. What's going on here? If you kind of really take that logic on board and follow it through, what you conclude is simply that it's meant to resemble a page number, but it isn't actually a page number. It's something else entirely, disguised as a page number. It's cryptography, or more specifically, steganography. Steganography, the difference between cryptography and steganography is, steganography is the kind of the James Bond end of stuff, the hiding the pill, or rather the micro dot, whereas cryptography is moving the letters around in a message and saying, there you are, that's the answer, but twisted around a bit.
Oh.
So, when you look at these funny page number things in the Voynichese, so, well, that's a bit strange. That isn't what it seems. Now, I had a bit of a problem with this, because when you look at the transcriptions of Voynichese, there's one called EVA, and that's the most famous one, but there are several others. If you look at that, they just say A, I, I, R, or A, I, I, N, which should be V, but really, but they kind of copy it literally, what it seems to say. But there's something that's missing. I went to the Beinecke, and they very kindly let me look at it, the Voynich manuscript, for 3 whole days.
Oh, there you go, really.
Yeah, this was in May 2006. And I thought, I want to understand what's going on in these pages, specifically in these funny little patterns. And I looked, I picked one page, and I stared at it for at least an hour, I can't remember how long it was, just thinking, well, there must be something here that I'm missing. And then, after about an hour or so, it did start to make sense. How it was made, and since then I've thought about it further and further, and I can say exactly what happened and how it came about. In the beginning, when the AIIVs were written down, the author also placed a dot above them, and the dot I think encoded something like probably a number, might be letter, probably a number. Now, and then later on, the author's come back and thought, you know, that's not really very secure. I've got to hide that somehow. And he's come back with a different pen, but very similar, but not quite identical ink. And he's gone from the dot and made a kind of flourish up and over and then round to the right.
Hmm.
And then kind of looped up with the right-hand stroke of the V. And if you look, you can see the different inks, with slightly different inks that are used on some pages. And this is only for the what are called the A pages, the herbal A pages. These are probably the earliest pages to be written. So all of a sudden, you've got this. So you can say how the pages were constructed. That the A pages were written with a dot to encode probably a number. And then later on, the author's come back, decided that it's not secure enough, added a kind of a flourish to hide the dot.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he carries on in the B pages, which is the later, slightly smaller handwriting, he's gone, he's used a completely different system. And the final V, he uses different shapes for the V. There's a different kind of encoding going on.
Mm.
Now, it's possible that this is just some kind of random thing, that it was just a change in style. But I don't really believe that. I'm certain that these are the stages of Cypher as it evolved. And I suppose that's the kind of the thing that I like to tell people now, is that if you want to get a real understanding of the Voynich, the key issue is not what it is, but how it evolved as it was made.
That is interesting.
If you stop being intimidated by it as a kind of fait accompli, here's this fantastic 200-page manuscript. Oh, you'll never understand it. No, here's this object that in a cipher that was kind of made up as it went along and grew and developed and adapted to solve whatever problems and obstacles the encipherer had as he was doing it. I say he, could be a she, but who knows? But it evolved to meet the challenge of whatever enciphering content that the person had.
That is interesting.
It's not a static thing. It's a thing that developed.
Yeah. So you think that it could also be kind of training or some kind of whoever wrote the document were doing so in an effort to also develop a certain type of ciphering language. Do I understand that correct?
Absolutely, yes. It certainly could be. You know, for example, Trithemius's ciphers, they kind of develop in his book and they get more and more complex. But still, if you actually break the ciphers as you're supposed to, then you find they're just like, a lot of them are just like little rhymes and little nonsense things. They're not, nothing very fancy. They're not, no great secrets. I mean, Trithemius is a famous codebreaker from just after this sort of time, very, very early 16th century. And he's done things that are for the sake of the cryptography. You know, he's interested in the process. Looking at the Voynich manuscript, sure, there's a similar kind of slightly experimental thing, but I think that it's experimental because it only insofar as it's adapting to solve practical challenges that have come up when you actually try to apply a thing.
That is interesting. And do you think that we can learn something from the document as a ciphering tool? I mean, if we compare it to you briefly mentioned at the beginning here some of the Nazi code, what is known as the Enigma code and so forth.
Yeah.
If we would compare that ciphering to this more ancient ciphering, would you say that the ancient ciphering is much, much more advanced and we have much to learn to come up to that level again?
Understanding the history of, if you understand the cipher history, the 15th century was the pinnacle of, was a point where, I'll start that again. If you understand the history of ciphers, the 15th century denotes the point where the technology of ciphering diverged in two directions. And one of the key type angles was very mathematical ciphering. Things like Wigner that came from Alberti and all different things like that. They basically said, how can we encipher a thing using mathematics, using transformations in a very kind of obvious way. Whereas there was a parallel strand which used not mathematical power, but actually a kind of brute force cunning that was more linked to steganography and deception and misleading. And so I think all the modern code-breaking tools are based around very mathematical approaches,
yeah.
Very statistical, numerical, and applied maths. But what I think we've got in the Voynich manuscript is something that's from a different tradition. It's from, I think it's the pinnacle of a parallel kind of cunning tradition. If cryptography had taken that turn rather than the mathematical turn, all modern codes would be based around cunning, not on mathematical transformations. But that was the point where it kind of like kind of split off, where people said, well, no, actually, we're not interested in that kind of James Bond stuff. We're interested in just the numbers, just the numbers, just the numbers. Because the numbers will, there'll be some kind of fantastic transform that will sort things out, and you'll never be able to break it. Mathematically unbreakable ciphers.
Do you think that even exists? So far, I guess all the ciphers that we do have out there in regards to numbers and mathematics have been pretty much broken, right?
There's a strong case to be made that there will never be an unbreakable, mathematically unbreakable cipher. And basically, that's, if you ask cryptologists, that's kind of the generally accepted view right now. You know, I think, you know, there are some people that have a different view that say that there will be unbreakable stuff. But I look at things like quantum computing, and I think that the ability of that to break very extremely mathematically complex things in finite time, in the long term, not this year, not next year, it is just staggering. And anyone who says that this mathematical transform is unbreakable, that it would take the lifetime of the universe to solve, may have met their comeuppance in quantum cryptography, quantum computers, because all of a sudden you can run a test that will take the lifetime of the universe just in parallel.
That is interesting. Do you think that's something in regards to, I mean, they are working on developing different quantum computers right now and so forth. Do you think that certain language, so to speak, can we learn rather something from these types of documents and this type of ciphering when we are developing things like the quantum computer, for instance?
I think that the quantum computer is just a kind of a mold-breaking, kind of game-changing tool that changes just how we think of what is possible and what's not possible. And there will doubtless be mathematical things that go beyond whatever we're up to at the moment. The pressure on people to develop these quantum computers is immense, because everyone wants them. You know, they really do.
So how has your success been? Is it for you unbreakable, or do you think that you've developed a better understanding of the document now and feel that you're coming closer and closer to an answer, or do you feel that you even have come to an answer in your that you present in your book and so forth?
I think I've got in my book. There are different types of history you can do. There's kind of very archival history. There's very personality history, and there's kind of all kinds of there's social history, all kinds of different things. But the kind of history that I do is called intellectual history, and it's not 'cause I'm clever. But that's just the name for it. And the principles of intellectual history is that ideas flow through time. And it's a bit like art history. What art historians do is that they look at the kind of brushstrokes that people made and the kind of marks they made and the techniques they used and how techniques apparently flowed through time. Someone's seen a picture and think, oh, I can use that trick, and then start using it themselves. Mm. And that gives you a kind of like a family tree of how things are linked together in a very almost diagrammatic visual sort of way. Intellectual history, it kind of expands that in a broader sense. It says, well, ideas do the same thing. Once you really understand a thing, you can say, where did that idea come from? And then, where did that idea come from? Where did that idea come from in turn? And you can put things into traditions and families and structures that locate people and their works within a kind of framework of everything around them. Now, so when I wrote the book, I tried to apply those kind of principles to the Voynich manuscript, insofar as I tried to link all the things I could say with some kind of certainty, with some kind of high probability, within an overall historical, and social, and cultural framework. And what I learned from that was really, as I say, you can date it to a certain kind of period, you can locate it to a certain kind of period. I think you can link it with other documents like Giovanni di Fontana's Books of Secrets and other trade secrets. I think I come to a thing that it's a kind of like I say, very middle class aspirational book where someone's trying to gain influence by almost trading or hiding secrets, and
by showing off almost in a way that look what I can do here.
Not quite, but I think it's a kind of a mixture. It's a kind of intellectual paranoia that he doesn't want his stuff to be lost or to be stolen. Lots of the designers and engineers and architects of the time were very paranoid about their works and their ideas. The famous story is about Brunelleschi. In Italy, Brunelleschi is revered above Da Vinci, basically. And you know, Da Vinci did a lot of nice stuff, but he didn't, as Steve Jobs would say, he didn't really ship. He didn't really deliver. And then a lot of the stuff he did was very kind of fleeting, like carnivals and stuff, and just impromptu rhymes. Whereas Brunelleschi actually designed things and built things and tried things. And he's Italians think the world of Brunelleschi. That's great. You know, he's a really amazing guy. Mm. But there's a famous story. In the cathedral in Florence, they needed to design they had design for the dome. But then they realized they had no way of getting stuff up there. They didn't have a crane that could get stuff from the ground, from the bottom to the top. And that's a real problem. So that what they did was they put out a competition. They said to everybody, okay, all you clever Florentines, you figure it out, and then we'll give you a prize if your answer's chosen. Mm. And the story goes that Brunelleschi put in his plans for have this fantastic crane. And then all these other guys were saying, well, you know, come on, tell us how it is. How to do it. What's the trick? He said, I'm not going to tell you. You know, if I tell you, you'll use it for yourself. And this is the kind of like paranoid inventor, designer, engineer thing I'm talking about. And they kept pestering him. And he said, okay, I'll show you. Here's an egg. I gave an egg. He said, make this egg stand up on its end. And they said, well, that's easy. He said, go on then. And they tried all different things and they couldn't do it. And they said, okay, well, they said to him, what do you mean then? And he said, okay, watch this. He got the egg and he went crunch.
He breaks it.
The end. And he broke the end.
Yes.
Crushed it down the table. So the end was flat. And the egg stood up. And they said, well, that's easy. You know, anyone could do that. He said, well, you couldn't tell if you couldn't 5 minutes ago. And if I told you my other secrets, you'd copy them as well.
Right.
So that's the kind of. And anyway, and Brunelleschi's crane, his hoist, had gears, had two speeds for getting big stuff and small stuff up, and it's reversible so that you could use an oxen that was or a horse that was driving it. They didn't like to walk backwards, so letting the horse go in the same direction for the crane to go up and down was a very important thing, and all these little things are in there. Brunelleschi's background was in watchmaking and clockmaking. And so this is a very inventive, very mechanistic, very, I know, this is kind of the dawn of modern machine inventing. You know, you can trace, you know, as an intellectual historian, you can trace that kind of the modern Taiwanese gears, all the little kind of ready control motors and things, mm-hmm. all the way back to Brunelleschi and that kind of like that place, Northern Italy, early 15th century.
Do you know if Brunelleschi was involved in ciphering as well?
Well, I think there's... there's a thing called the Zibaldone. of a workbook, basically, by Lorenzo Ghiberti's grandson, whose first name escapes me. And some of that's written in cipher. And the cipher pages are for hoists and that kind of stuff. And I've got a feeling that some of that basically came from Brunelleschi. Brunelleschi was very famously paranoid, wouldn't even write stuff down. So no, I don't think he did. But people around him were ciphering things, and it's a very tightly packed set of people doing a certain kind of same sort of thing.
Mm.
So I think that when I look at some pages in the Voynich, there's some. If you look at the plant pages, the herbal pages, there are two types of pages. There's what are called A language and B language, or hand one, hand two. Now, the A language pictures, I think, are probably pictures of plants in some kind of way. But if you look at the B language pictures, the hand two, there's something that's just wrong about them. They look like gears and wheels and all different things, and boats and machines. And I think that what's happening in the and also you have to remember that the pages have all been page orders have been scrambled over the centuries.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the herbal page in the Voynich, you've got two different types of thing going on. And I think what you have is some obscured plants in the A pages, the early pages. But in the B pages, I think you might just have obscured machines that have basically been disguised as plants in order to hide them. So trying to hide things in plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
So the legacy of Brunelleschi and all your inventive Florentines of the early 15th century and Giovanni Fontana and all that kind of thing is very much alive but hidden in these pictures. Now you have to remember that at this point there's a Voynich researcher called Elias Schwetweger, and his famous thing is the Voynich bullshit index. And which is basically when people start claiming things and pointing things, pretty much his kind of his bullshit meter kind of goes up, and this is the kind of thing that he would say is bullshit, probably.
Hmm.
But you have to remember that when you're looking at this kind of stuff, you're looking right at the edge of something that is just very hard to see. It's very hard to be sure either way.
It almost, a little bit, as you talk here, it sounds to me almost that this specific ciphering as well is almost like a kind of, how should we put it, patenting, you know, in a way. Before there was a patent office, so to speak, this exactly. was a way to hide it.
This
right?
was exactly the period when patents were first made. In fact, the first patent was to Brunelleschi.
Oh, so, really? There you go.
So, yeah. It was very, very limited. They started out with a very limited geographic range.
Yes.
And they would have patent for a few years in a certain place. It was a largely ineffective system, to be honest. That kind of accounts for the kind of paranoia that inventors had, because, you know, much like modern manufacturers looking at China, thinking, "Oh yes, I can build this thing," but what happens when the Chinese copy it in 6 months' time?
Yes.
Then you have to look at other ways of making it hard for them to copy, or just not disclosing details. So yeah, I think that there's this kind of drives help. I think that was one of the factors that fed into the Voynich author's paranoia, fear of copying and fear of loss of ownership.
Huh. Well, that's an interesting point of view, Nick. And what I'd like to do is take a little break here and continue asking you a little bit more about some of the things inside the document. And we can maybe even go into some of the other ciphering things that you've talked about. I want to ask a little bit about the maybe the Enigma code, and there's something known as the cryptos outside the CIA headquarters. Don't know if you're aware of that, but I'm going to ask you about that later on.
Okay, that's fine.
But we'll take a little break here. But please, before we round off hour one here, Nick, for us, let us know your websites again and the title of your book so people who want to dig deeper into your work can do that.
Oh, well, the book's called The Curse of the Voynich. Really, the curse of the Voynich is why the force that makes, stops people decoding it. So The Curse of the Voynich, I wrote in 2006, and it really covers a lot of these things, and it's a good read. I only have 11 copies left of my print run, so if you want one, you better act quick.
Better hurry, that's right.
Yeah, it's a collector's item after that.
Give us the website just so we can,
the website
we can get a copy.
Is, the website for that is compellingpress.com/Voynich. It's my printing company, so my print house, so... hence, Nick Pelling Compelling. There you go. Very bad pun.
There we go. And you have the main website, cipheringmysteries.com.
Cipheringmysteries.com, yeah.
Yes.
Because basically, there are lots of other broadly similar cipher mysteries that I find just interesting in different ways. So, yeah, cipheringmysteries.com. Lots of fun there.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Nick. Stay with us, and we'll be right back. All right, join us in our member section for our continuation with Nick Pelling. We are going to talk about Gordon Rugg, alchemical symbols in the manuscript, astronomical images, and Filarate, or Antonio Averlino, who Nick believes is the author of the document. We also spend a little bit of time talking about Alan Turing, the Enigma Code, the Anthictera Mechanism, Ptolemy, and the Cryptos Code, this monument outside the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. So much more is coming up for Red Ice members. Go to redicecreations.com for much more information. Also, stay tuned for more radio coming up with Ellen Brown, our part two with Andrew Bashago, Kevin P. Miller, David Icke, and many more. But we'll be back after some music.